Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 173, Science Faction, the Mesoproterozoic Era.
Now, after each one of these intros for almost 200 episodes, I usually put a joke after we do this, but I feel like geological eras is the most comedically restricting of the comedic intros we've had.
I don't know. I feel like geological eras lead themselves to a lot of comedy. I mean, there's a lot of words that kind of sound like dick.
Okay, let me try. The Mesoproterozoic, or as the Native Americans called it, maize.
No, goddammit, no. Okay, so the Mesoproterozoic is part of the Proterozoic eon. Last week we did the Paleoproterozoic era from about 2.5 billion years ago to about 1.6 billion years ago. And this week's Mesoproterozoic era goes from 1.6 billion years ago to about 1 billion years ago. Again, huge stretches of time. Those just sound like random numbers. That is a gigantic stretch of time. The subdivisions of this era aren't really indicative of major events. We talked last week about certain large-scale events like photosynthetic life starting, snowball Earth, all that kind of stuff. Those marked boundaries, which a lot of geological periods are kind of broken up is. These are not broken up. The periods within the Mesoproterozoic era aren't. They're just kind of random sections of time that delineate that we can kind of separate that out some. But we don't have a lot of information about major events in this era. We know that there's the breakup of the Columbia supercontinent and the formation of the Rodinia supercontinent. We'll see throughout these older periods of time, basically because of plate tectonics, large land masses are pulling apart and getting pushed back together. This is, you know, still pre-Pangaea, pre-Gondwana land, pre a lot of the ones we know about, but these are still large major supercontinents breaking up, pulling together, and kind of slowly forming a map. The Earth right now, the land masses would look nothing like what you're currently used to.
Our antitrust laws used to be great. You could break up continents if they got too big. Now we can't even do this to telecom. But those are the highlights.
Well, I'll tell you, I saved one great highlight of this particular era, which is the evolution of sexual reproduction. This is when sex finally comes in.
Okay, why didn't you lead with that? You buried the lead.
That's right. Now we get into our own era. This is about a billion years ago, and we're going to see that you might think, wow, life has actually been around for a long time. We've been talking about how we've had life at least a few billion years. How is it that we just got sexual reproduction? Sexual reproduction is kind of a different thing, but it also leads to vastly different types of life, which is what we're going to see in the next billion years. As we see things progress from here, we're going to see that because of that recombination of genes in that unique way, evolution takes hold in a whole different manner, and survival of the fittest has a whole different tool in which to build new organisms. So all of the things we see, all the big macro animals, lizards, dinosaurs, amphibians, fish, everything we see that's big and interesting and neat comes around after sexual reproduction makes it possible for genes to be combined in a new way. So in that sense, this era has a very important purpose, which is it gives us the thing that makes life both interesting and worth living, which is boning.
It also gave Damien his first job.
Sexual reproductionist. Yeah, I was in charge of teaching the first organisms how to bone. They didn't know. What's after sexual reproduction? Like, what would be the next pansexual reproduction where I could exchange genes with any?
Yeah, horizontal gene transfer. Maybe the bacteria that are going in and kind of taking stuff. Okay,
don't take the insertion out of this. Okay. This is.
There still needs to be penetration for this to work out.
I don't care. I'll be a bottom. I don't care, but penetration has to be involved.
Seems kind of like your motto. And speaking of a scientist who has a very similar motto, I am your host, comedian and archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. Still lost in thought from that bottom topic a second ago.
Yeah, you seem very distracted.
I'm going to be in my thoughts for the next 20 minutes or so.
And, of course, our scientist for the evening, Ian. Ian, how are you doing?
Not too bad.
And we, of course, are broadcasting this from the Madhouse Comedy Club along the skyline of beautiful downtown San Diego. Come on out to Madhouse to see the Saturday Night Showcase. And when you're not doing that, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com and our Twitter at Faction Science. As a side note to you guys, I want to thank everybody for going and checking out that blog post on the Mastodon article we covered last week. I have been getting a shocking amount of hate mail from, I imagine not our listeners, but just general scientific community for writing that blog. Honestly, it's not the best written thing I have done on that website by far. It is not a particularly impressive article, though I do find it interesting, but I have been getting more responses from that one article than all the other ones we have on there combined, so I guess keep spreading that around. It's working because it's pissing some people off.
Who's it pissing off? People who don't think that hominids existed here?
No, the ones that do, because if you remember, I'm disputing what the Cerruti site states and their conclusions, and what happens is people get very excited about mainstream science articles that become very exciting, and if you shoot that down, you're taking that excitement away from them. So you get a lot of, oh, you're just angry you didn't find it, and it's like, no, I mean, I'm super excited. I used to be super excited about this site when I first found out about it in 2009. I'm sad that I have to be disappointed in the work that was done on it.
I'm sad because we'd established last episode that there was nothing exciting about this article. And I'm actually sad that several people have emailed you to confirm your bias.
That's true.
There's anything remotely interesting about this article.
I did get two or three emails from supportive, what I assume to be science faction fans. So thank you guys for doing that. And if not, just go ahead and go check out our website, www.thesciencefaction.com. Look in the blog section, read that Mastodon blog, and go ahead and post it on your own Facebook wall. See if you get half as much hate mail as I did, or maybe you'll just increase my own personal hate mail.
You know, Damien would like some hate mail, too. Bobby's not the only one who says horrible things on this show. Damien, I think, puts in a lot of legwork in saying a lot of terrible things on this show.
That's true, actually, Damien. You do. You know what? You don't get recognized enough for all the horrible things you say.
I am the Sacagawea to your Lewis and Clark in the terrible things westward trip we're taking.
That's the second Native American joke you've made on this episode. I think that deserves some hate mail.
I think it deserves some fire water, my boy.
All right, and speaking of something exciting that's going on at the Madhouse, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, guys, first article, another one of those ones that you saw on a bunch of the science news sites, though admittedly not as much as the Cerruti Mastodon site, the smoking link to autism. So we've talked before plenty of times about how autism, through all intents and purposes that we can tell, is a genetic disorder. It is something that is inherited along certain genetic lines. In some cases, we know the markers for specific types of autism, which is one of the reasons that things like vaccine claims don't check out, because a vaccine isn't going to change your DNA. But there is a study that comes out of the University of Bristol that has been making the waves that seems to suggest that your maternal grandmother smoking while she was pregnant with your mother could increase your odds of being autistic, or at least of displaying autistic traits. So the University of Bristol looked at 14,500 participants of children from the 90s and found out that if a girl's maternal grandmother smoked during pregnancy, the girl is 67% more likely to display certain traits linked to autism, such as poor social communication skills and repetitive behaviors.
To be fair, my grandmother looked fucking awesome when she smoked.
Oh, she looked cool as shit.
Yeah, flipped up her collar on her leather jacket, dropped her shades.
Did the smoke rings every once in a while? Okay, so what they are claiming is that in looking at this, they are seeing this correlation, and they are postulating a possible causation, which is there is DNA damage that can be transmitted from a mother to a child. We know that from epigenetic studies. We know that from methylation that happens at the end of DNA strings. It's essentially inherited DNA changes, almost like Lamarckianism. But what they're suggesting is that when the maternal grandmother smokes while she's pregnant, she causes some damage, not necessarily to her eggs, because again, this is skipping a generation, but to the eggs that are developing inside the fetus within her. While we have covered on Science Faction the fact that there are rare cases in which a woman can create eggs during her lifetime, for the most part, all the eggs that a woman has throughout her life, she is born with. It's kind of crazy when you think about it, because men continuously produce sperm. We do it all the time. You usually won't hold on to sperm for any longer than, you know, 2 weeks. You get rid of it. It's done. Women.
Like, do you, like, spit it out, or, like, what do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Spit it out.
You're not supposed to spit, Damien.
Oh.
Yeah, it's rude.
3 days is my record.
Women, on the other hand, they are born with a certain amount of eggs, and for the most part, keep those eggs throughout their entire life, and for the most part, don't develop new eggs. So, what that means is, if this maternal grandmother has something going on during the gestation of her female fetus, then you could theoretically see how that damage would translate down to the granddaughter level. Well, one of the ideas is that this might attack the mitochondrial DNA. Now, we talked about mitochondria before. Everybody has them. You inherit it directly from your matrilineal side. You get your mom's mitochondrial DNA. The mitochondria are like the powerhouses of the cell. It's what fuel and power the cell. So what they're saying is maybe there's damage to the mitochondrial DNA that's being passed on to the eggs inside the mother, and therefore when she has kids, those are the issues. And so the idea is that the impact of this would increase over that second generation as opposed to decrease. Now, this is an interesting claim. It's still a bold claim. It is not particularly proven because they can't look and say, look, we have this issue with these mitochondria. We know they inherited it, so therefore we know what happened. But what they are saying is we are seeing this very strong correlation. We think it might be a causation, and here's a particular pathway that we think the causation could go down. This is highly different from somebody saying, hey, look, we think we see a correlation with vaccines, which, by the way, doesn't exist, but we see this correlation with vaccines, and here is the method by which this could happen. They don't have that method. They don't have that scientific pathway of one thing to another. Here's how a vaccine would cause you to be autistic. In this case, they do. They're saying you have damage to mitochondrial DNA, and maybe it comes out. Now, again, completely speculative at this point. Nothing proven in that sense. And we have to start asking ourselves the age-old question anytime we see a study like this. Causation versus correlation. You know, maybe the women that are smoking, keep in mind also, this is University of Bristol. They're looking at a lot of English women. What's going on at the time these grandmothers are having kids back then, the 1940s? There was a kind of conflict, I think, or something. Wasn't there like some kind of skirmish going on over by England at that point?
Are you referring to mad cow disease? Yes, I think that happened in England around a similar time.
That World War II caused a lot of problems over there. Maybe there's a correlation between women who are smoking and women who are in very extreme stressful circumstances at that point during World War II. You're getting bombed nonstop by the Germans. You have your windows blacked out. You have limited supplies. Your husband, son, father, brother, whatever, are probably off at war or killed at war. So you're in a lot of stressful circumstances. It might be that the women at that point in history, especially when it's less socially acceptable for women to smoke, it might be that the women who smoked at that time were the ones who were stressed out the most. It might be that they were the ones who were in a lower socioeconomic class. Maybe we are seeing an epigenetic difference in these young granddaughters, and it has nothing to do with smoking. It's just that the women who happen to experience poverty and stress also happen to smoke a lot as well.
I remember there was a study that came out not too long ago, maybe a few months, that also linked stress. I think it was specifically starvation stress.
Yes, yes.
That actually caused a positive effect in, again, the grandchildren,
right,
those who experience the starvation.
There's been a few of those epigenetic studies. That's actually one of the first ones that was done, looked at starvation in two generations back and how it affects the health of the grandchildren of that generation. And they also found a strong correlation. But again, we couldn't say for sure this was causational.
So is there just a generation of women who grew up with grandmothers in the 50s who are displaying this type? And don't women also display autistic symptoms much less than men?
Yeah.
Good
point. A 1-to-4 ratio in terms of women with autism displaying to men with autism displaying.
And what percentage of women whose grandmother smoked, was it correlated to?
Well, they said they had a 67% increase. We would expect to have this many women, young girls with autism. We see 67% more, which is a very significant number. And here is the correlation we're doing. It happens to do with the grandmother smoking. But again, could have to do with the grandmother's stress level. Could be with the grandmother's exposure to certain things that were going on at wartime. It could be starvation. It could even be that it has nothing to do with the grandmother's. It's just that the second generation, the one that we've skipped here in between the grandmother and the granddaughter, the mother's generation, maybe that mother, because she grew up in a place where a grandmother was smoking, happened to grow up in a lower socioeconomic class, and we're just seeing a standard economic divide going down the middle.
I'm going to try to advocate for women and try to take some of the stress off grandmothers here. What if all the great mates died in the war and they just were forced to mate with all these dudes who were prone to having grandchildren with autism?
That's true.
Who couldn't fight in the war?
You had a much smaller population of men to breed with, right? And who is going to be less likely to die in war? The regular dude who's gung-ho is going to run out there, or the autistic guy who's slightly scared of loud noises and makes more calculated decisions?
Alan Turing, I believe you're referring to Alan Turing.
Damien, you usually come up with horrible ideas, but this is a really good one, actually. It could be that we just narrowed down the gene breeding pool in England in the 1940s to autistic dudes who were more likely to have autistic daughters and granddaughters.
They ended up chemically castrating Alan Turing anyway, so if they just had done it sooner to all the autistic people.
That was the problem I think a lot of people had, is not enough chemical castrations of people who were just displaying.
Won the war for the country?
Yeah.
Thank you for your service, Mr. Turing. Please receive your testicular injection.
This is interesting stuff. I think it needs to be followed up on. I am always skeptical of large epigenetic claims like this, that's especially the ones that skip a generation, but they do have a method of action, which means it is possible. We shouldn't dismiss it outright the way we do with some of the vaccine stuff. It needs more study. They said they've controlled for variables to eliminate things like socioeconomics. I find it hard to believe that they can control for broader variables like stress or position in the war, other things like that, though. So, again, it might be that smoking causes this. It might be that smoking is a reflection of a broader lifestyle going on that causes this. Or it might have nothing to do with epigenetics and have a completely separate explanation that appears to be this. Until we find a definitive mechanism of action and we can show, yes, this is how it happened, not just how we think it did, we won't know that. But for now, it's a super interesting article that should make you think twice about smoking while you're pregnant. Not that you should be doing that anyway.
I say, as if there weren't enough reasons already.
Right.
Maybe British women are being punished for calling cigarettes fags.
That's true. They are very homophobic about their cigarettes. What you're saying is that God, of course, the champion of gay rights,
yes,
has decided, hey, ladies, I find this offensive, even though you're not really intending to be offensive with this, and I would probably be more offended by the fact that you're smoking while pregnant. But regardless, I find that offensive, and therefore I'm going to make your granddaughters, who you might not even meet, autistic.
Fancy a fag, love. Don't care if me granddaughter gets the autism.
All right, let's move on to article number 2, exercise and a pill. Very interesting article that looks at a particular drug compound, GW501516 and GW1516, that seems to basically give the exact same benefits as exercise when you take it with absolutely no exercise put in. So this isn't like steroids where, you know, if you sat there and just took steroids but didn't work out, it wouldn't do anything for you, really.
Would it still make Damien's testicles smaller?
Oh, yeah. It would still shrink the hell out of his testicles.
Oh, thank God. I'm trying to make my penis look bigger. And by comparison...
Right. It is a good trick. But this is one where you literally just take the pill. You don't do any more exercise, and you get the benefits of having done the exercise. It's almost like saying, hey, look, we know when you exercise, your body does these things. How can we replicate these things without making you exercise?
So it just causes a really fast heartbeat? Does it cause you to just do curls on your own? But like, right. It doesn't burn any calories? And
well, so what's interesting is when they say the same effect as exercise, obviously you're not having the same calorie burning, right? Because calorie burning is literally work done. It is putting fuel into a gas tank and then having the gas tank run, and you're burning up that fuel. So you're not losing calories the way you would when you exercise. But your body shows the same endurance that you get. In fact, when they did it on these mice, and these are still an animal test, the pill itself, after 8 weeks of treatment, the mice that took the pill could run 70% longer. That's almost doubling their initial abilities with absolutely no extra training. All they're doing is taking a pill.
I'm picturing in the lab, you could tell the placebo mice from the mice who took the drug, because the mice who took the drug are like in Speedos, jacked, like modeling. There's a bodybuilding competition going on inside one of the rat cages.
Well, so I think one thing that is interesting is that this, it seems to focus specifically on endurance, not necessarily musculature.
Right. So it's not like muscle fibers, but muscle action. So one of the things that this particular pill does is it alters the metabolic pathway that converts fat to energy instead of sugar to energy. So you guys might know this if you're big into...
My God, the untapped strength in America.
I know, right? We could be the most fit nation in the world. Forget 70%. Our guys won't stop running. They're Forrest Gumping across this goddamn country.
The American South is now pulling its weight.
Literally. Those of you who are into nutrition might know this as representing something like the ketone diet, where you're essentially taking your body and training it to stop burning sugar and carbs and start burning fat. That also goes on during regular exercise. When you're just regularly exercising, your body starts processing fat in different ways. So what this pill does is essentially start making your body do what it naturally does when you're exercising. And in doing that, in just going through that separate metabolic pathway, at least in these mouse studies, seems to indicate you get the benefits of the exercise itself.
So it's like putting NOS into like a really shitty car. The car's not any better.
No.
You're just putting better fuel into...
Well, except the car is better because that car is then able to function in a better fashion. That car is able to go 70% longer.
Am I going to burn out the engine? Is there any... How many trannies did they have to replace in these mice?
Wait, I know trannies?
Yes, I know.
Damien, First of all, he says fag. Then he brings in trannies. David, you just can't stop with your offensive comments.
You really want that hate mail, don't you?
Listen, Breitbart listeners are going to be a key demographic for this podcast going forward. If I sent you an email, the business model.
They did previous studies on genetically engineered mice that were actually genetically engineered to kind of go through this metabolism process naturally, and they found that they had these increased gains. This is a more interesting study to me, because what this says is if you take a normal mouse and give it a pill, you can get the same effect as these transgenic mice. In that case, that opens the possibility that us, as regular human beings who go through normal metabolic pathways, can take the pill and get that same benefit that these mice in this particular study show.
Now, I did read in one of the linked articles that there were some human trials that were done, but they were mysteriously, or not mysteriously, but for reasons not stated, canceled.
Well, a couple things. One is, this has not gotten full approval yet. But people are trying it on their own. You can order these drugs online. I don't want to give out the exact name. Let's just say it rhymes with G5501516. But you can go and get these online and try them yourself. And people are doing that. These have been known the last few years as basically performance-enhancing drugs, ones that some organizations don't test for. So it makes it even more enticing to athletes to try and use these, especially when you're not saying, hey, you know, you're going through a, you're adding a completely different type of testosterone your body doesn't produce or something like that, like you would with a steroid. You're saying, hey, that normal thing that happens when you exercise, we're just doing that already.
So every athlete could be on this right now.
Theoretically. Well, I mean, in the organizations that do not test for it, yes.
How do they test for it?
The same way they would test for anything else. They'd look for the metabolites in your urine or in your blood.
MMA?
I don't know. USADA has very strict testing rules, so I would imagine probably.
Wait till you see your first morbidly obese fighter. Yeah. That'll be a key.
Roy Nelson? Yeah, he's already been around for a while.
Well, but again, this is more endurance than strength.
Yeah.
So we're talking like if you see an obese marathon runner breaking records, that might be an indication of something.
How are you discriminating?
Well, one thing we should kind of caution people. One thing to think is there's always an issue with translation to humans. Just because something works in mice does not mean that it's going to work in humans. We've seen that over and over again. That's why we have different phases of study where we look at those things as independently. There can also be other complications that we wouldn't know about, including things like anytime you alter metabolic pathways, you always have to be concerned about cancer. Are you going to alter a metabolic pathway that allows a cell to grow out of control? So anytime you kind of mess with those things, that has to be something you have in the back of your head. Also, we have to note that, like Ian said, the muscles of the mice didn't show the changes that typically accompany the aerobic fitness, like extra mitochondria, more blood vessels, or more fibers. They were just able to perform this particular task. That, in a way, makes it more interesting, because we're not exactly replicating the exercise, but we're replicating the benefits. Super, super interesting stuff in that sense. What we should expect in future studies is, one, detailed human trials with large N numbers. Number two, we would like to see, does this endurance switching from metabolizing sugar to metabolizing fat, does this particular type of increased endurance that we see in these mice replicate directly over to humans? And if so, do we see a difference between the people who have just taken the pill and those who went through some kind of controlled version of exercise to mimic those pills things? Do we see that, yes, they can both run the same distance, but afterwards one of them recovers much faster? Yes, they can both run the same distance, the same extra distance, but afterwards one of them has serious issues with metabolizing at a normal pace, and so their heart rate stays up really high in a dangerous fashion. All of these things are questions that you would have to ask as you get into more detailed human trials. Regardless, super interesting that later on, we might be seeing people just pop a pill and get a 70% increase in their cardio output and how much they're able to run.
Nobody is more excited than this than your fat mama.
That's true. All right, guys, let's move right on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
That is the biggest lie in podcasting, and you fucking know it. Everybody's favorite game. In this room, I don't even think it's your favorite game.
It is my favorite game. I love watching you fail. All right, guys, I Call BS is, of course, the game where I read 4 science news articles to my panelists who compete to see which ones are true and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Of course.
Yeah, now let's do this.
All right, article number 1. New studies in Neanderthal skeletons reveal that many of them suffered skeletal damage similar to that of modern-day rodeo riders. Damien, is this science Or bad science.
Yeah, it doesn't. I'd say this is science. It wouldn't surprise me if Neanderthals suffered injuries similar to those who've had sex with a rodeo rider. Yeah.
I said similar to rodeo riders, Damien.
I hear what I want to hear.
Okay, fair enough. And, of course, Ian.
I'm going to say this is science.
All right, article number two. Vancouver police have come across a bird's nest made completely of used opiate needles. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, but I'm tempted to say science because Canada does have a strong endowment for the arts, and I could see them even giving money to pigeons for a project like this.
Oh, so it's not an actual bird's nest. They're just like, hey, express yourself using the tools at hand.
The problem is they have with that is that they have socialized healthcare, so addiction is handled a lot. This seems like an American thing where they'd have to like import the needles. I'm going to say bad science.
All right, Andy, Ian.
I'm actually going to say bad science, and I hate to admit this, but for the same reasons as Damien, this seems like something that would happen in America, not Canada.
Gotcha. All right, article number three. Scientists have recently discovered the 1,300-year-old skull of a king bear, a Native American legendary polar bear more than 12 feet long. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It was actually chief bear.
Oh, he wasn't a king. Yeah. He was a chief.
Native Americans didn't respect a monarchy.
You know what? You're being really culturally sensitive, Damien. I appreciate that. Thank you. For once.
Maze.
God damn it. And Ian.
I'll go science on this one.
All right. And lastly, article number four. A new study indicates a small but measurable drop in physical strength in people as they swear. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. There was this one time that my kid was caught underneath the car, and I fucking flipped it.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. Well,
was that like...
So would you say this is bad fucking science?
Bad fucking science, bro.
Was this like the little tyke's little red car with the yellow roof that you flipped?
Yeah, that's why I couldn't flip a real car. What do you... Yeah.
That'd be crazy.
I swear a lot.
Well, was your kid still in the car when you flipped it?
Yeah, he's dead now. That's I'm child-free is the way to be.
And Ian.
I'm going to say bad science. I've actually seen a lot of articles recently saying that swearing is linked to positive attributes, so I'm just going to go with that trend.
Yeah, every time I see those, we're like, hey, it turns out people who swear more are smarter. It seems so dubious. I just imagine that the researcher who's writing it is like, you motherfuckers, I'll tell you fucking what. This is what fucking happened. Like, he's just he's the sailor mouthist motherfucker who just says stuff all the time and wants to confirm that he indeed is smarter than everybody else.
Yeah. That's why every degenerate drug addict usually has very clean speech. You know,
that's
usually
right.
Respects the Queen's English.
All right, let's
or
go.
The King Bear's English.
It's Chief Bear.
All right, let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one. New studies in Neanderthal skeletons reveal that many of them suffered skeletal damage similar to that of modern-day rodeo riders. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is bad science. That's actually what we used to think. There used to be a bunch of reports saying, all the damage to these Neanderthal skeletons, they look like what rodeo riders would have. What's really interesting is that a lot of paleoanthropologists brought up some good points, which was, you have a flawed sample. Most of the time we find Neanderthal skeletons, we find them in the caves that they lived in. So if they were buried in that particular cave because of sedimentation and preservation, that's where we find them. If they end up dying out in nature, out in a field, they're going to get scavenged by animals, ravaged, and taken away, and the bones won't be preserved. Most of the preserved fossils we have are of the Neanderthals who died back home or were able to make it back home. Guess who doesn't make it back home? People with broken legs. So you get a lot of upper body injuries that reflect the same type of damage that we see in rodeo riders because those are the individuals who made it back to the cave to die in such a way we could find their bones.
Okay, that makes sense. But what is the most famous archaeological rodeo rider site that we compare all these bones to?
What is the control sample
here? Yeah, right. Well, what's really interesting is what a new review of damage to Neanderthal bones actually found that even then, the damage that we see in the upper body is not really equivalent to rodeo riders. We see a lot of different types of damage that happen to their bones. I want to have you guys guess this. What activity do you think leads to very similar, close to identical damage to modern-day human bones that we see in the skeletons of long-dead Neanderthals?
Gymnastics.
Ian?
Riding Damien's mom.
She's a demanding lady.
Water tubing. The thing where you get dragged behind a boat in a water tube and, like, when the people crash in shut, that seems to be the most mimicking of what happens in these Neanderthal skeletons. These guys are hunting megalithic fauna, likely without projectile weapons, meaning they have to get close up to these mammoths, these mastodon, these rhinos, with spears and hit them. So they're used to taking dramatic hits. And apparently the thing that mimics that the most in modern day lifetime is water tubing.
What if you guys have gotten it all wrong? What if they would launch water tubes at mammoths and that simulated the injury?
They would launch themselves in a water tube.
I would say what I'm actually hoping really happened is they tied a rope around a mammoth in an inner tube.
Woo! We gotta tire him out! They're just crashing into each other. Yeah, that actually sounds pretty fun. The other injury or activity that seems to mimic the damage we see in Neanderthals a lot? Hitting yourself on a kitchen table.
Intentionally or?
No, just like bumping into a table or falling down and hitting your head on one. Again, likely because that is the type of trauma we see that gets reflected in kind of like craniofacial head injuries. That's kind of what we see reflected in them a lot. So if you ever smash your head on a table or run into a dude and break a bone while water tubing, just think, hey, I'm kind of like the Neanderthals right now.
Something to brag about.
All right, article number two. Vancouver police have come across a bird's nest made of used opiate needles. Both of you guys thought this one was bad science, and this one is science. At least that's what they said. They texted out a picture of what they said they found, which go to our website, check it out. It is very interesting because it is literally in a sink, like in an abandoned building sink. And it is in the city of Vancouver, which has a horrible, horrible opiate problem right now. People are using in mass quantities. And one of the things that they have going on that's really bad is fentanyl, which is about 100 times stronger than heroin. And that is out there. So there's all these users using these fentanyl needles. They found what they, at least they show a picture of it. Maybe they've staged it. Who knows? But they show what they claim to be a bird's nest made completely out of these fentanyl needles. All the needles are sitting there like interwoven as like a pile with three eggs sitting on the top.
That seems very uncomfortable to sit on.
Right? I'm going to guess they have the little needle caps on them so that they're not actually being poked. But even then, they're just hard. Like, they're not soft things.
Yeah, and do they also have, like, a bunch of drugged-out birds, like, laying around? Like, or?
No wonder they abandoned their eggs in this nest.
Maybe this is the bird's natural defense. You know how they say, don't touch a nest or
right.
A mama bird won't come back? Maybe mama bird's like, nobody's touching this nest. It's made of fucking needles.
Yeah, it's essentially just barbed wire on the outside of their nest. I like that idea. Go ahead and check out the picture of it on our website. It's actually quite interesting to see. Article number three. Scientists have recently discovered the 1,300-year-old skull of a king bear, a Native American legendary polar bear more than 12 feet long. Damien thinks this is false. Ian thinks this is true, and this one is science, making Ian the winner for this week. Way to go, Ian! I know we've only hit three of the four, but you guys said the same answer for the fourth one, so you indeed took this one, Ian. Congratulations for once again winning. It's just par for the course now. That's just what we expect.
Well, I mean, Ian, you know you are a smart man. You know this game is set up for you to win. Are you really going to take pride in kicking a homeless man?
You're homeless?
Oh, I live in a car.
Wait, did you flip it? Did you flip it so now your roof is the bottom of the car?
Yeah, it is upside down. My car has wheels, but it does not operate because the wheels are not on the ground. I have not been able to summon the calories to curse enough to flip the car back.
It sounds like he's not doing well, but he's actually improved his station a lot in life. Few people know he was actually born on a pile of needles.
And fed, vomited up pigeon food, worms.
But this is indeed very, very interesting. This skull measures 16 inches from front to back, way longer than your average skull. If you look, again, you're going to have to see a picture. Go to our website. Check out the picture of the two polar bear skulls side by side. This is dramatically different. It is a much longer skull. They think it might actually be a different subspecies, maybe even different species of polar bear. They then looked at this skull and said, wow, these measurements are weird. Not only is it bigger, but it's bigger in a weird way. The first part, the front part of the skull, looks exactly the same as a regular polar bear. Then it looks like somebody did, like when they take a Lincoln Town Car and cut it down the middle and then add a middle part to make it into a limo. That's what it looks like they did to this polar bear skull. They took the front part of the skull and the very, very back, which is essentially the same, and then they added like a good 4 inches in the middle to this thing. So it looks like a dramatically different animal. You could imagine that the size of this animal would be dramatically different. The Native Americans have a legend of something they call a king bear, which kind of fits this description. And in taking this skull and going back to an entire collection of polar bear skulls that have been collected over 1,000 years and looking, they actually found some similarities with a few others in other parts of the Arctic that might end up being that we see a representation of a subspecies or whole nother species of polar bear up there at some point. Very, very, very interesting.
How do we know this wasn't just the Paul Bunyan of polar bears?
Well, again, it's like a different... It's not just the size. It's actually the dimensions are different. It would be more like...
It's like the chunk from the Goonies of the polar bears.
You know what it'd be more like? It would be like those Inca cultures where they used boards to flatten the skull and change it and deform the shape. It would be more like that version of the polar bear. Like this polar bear's mom used flat boards, tied it to its skull when it was a baby, and deformed it so it had a weird-shaped skull.
Or a narrow...
Is that a discounted fact?
It could... Listen, a lot of things could be happening with this king bear.
Narrow polar bear vaginas would answer that skull question right there.
Super interesting stuff. Go look at that picture on our website while you're checking out our Mastodon article from last week. Article number 4, a new study indicates a small but measurable drop in physical strength in people as they swear. Both of you guys thought this one was bad science, and this one is... bad science. So even though Damien loses, he ends on a high note. Congratulations, Damien.
Wait. You're giving me a compliment. Is there like some sort of snide sarcasm behind that?
You did lose, but I was just, saying even though you lost. Indeed, it is the opposite. As Ian mentioned, there's a lot of stuff going around about the positive aspects of swearing. This is similar to that. They actually found that you have a slight 3-4% measurable increase in strength as you swear. And this goes along with previous studies that have shown repeatedly that you have a higher tolerance for pain as you swear, which is probably why, as something is hurting you, you're yelling, fuck, 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 fuck. You're kind of activating an excitement part of your brain and pumping yourself up. And in doing so, you're giving yourself a slightly higher immunity to pain. And as this study shows, maybe a slightly higher ability to use your muscles strength-wise.
The more taboo the word, do you unlock more strength? So
that's interesting. So like if you're just yell incest, then you can flip your car.
Well, I was thinking if you're like you're at a strength training competition or like an NFL combine where you really got to put your strength on display.
Right.
Are people just dropping the N-bomb every 2 seconds?
I think they're doing that anyway, but that's just the culture of the NFL. So
yeah, the white players get a lot of looks. Like, who's just want the same access to strength endurance?
Very interesting. So next time you're trying to do something heavy, go ahead and let a few F-bombs out. See if that helps out. Maybe you'll be able to lift a little bit heavier objects. All right. Congratulations, Ian, on that beautiful win. Let's move right on to Damien Channels, a dead scientist.
And now, Damien Channels, a dead scientist.
Don't go fuck yourself.
Welcome to Damien Channels, a dead scientist. The only thing that makes me feel better after the previous bit. Bobby? I'm about to tell everybody that I'm about to channel a spirit of a long-dead scientist, but You have a different take on it. Do you want to explain
you're lying. You just shake a lot, and then you pretend to be a scientist that you haven't researched enough for us to not pick it apart with questions.
But there was that one time.
Yeah. That's true. He did channel Jackie one time, and the old scientist who worked on us on the show with us. That was rather convincing, actually. But other than that one time, I have not seen anything.
Fans? You've installed doubt in the fans' minds, so now they know that,
Okay, let's see if you can convince them.
Okay.
And this is when he goes into the trance thing where he just shakes.
Spirits.
Always has to say the word spirits to call the spirits in.
Yes. Hello. Who is summoning the spirit of Robert Hooke to this madhouse comedy club? This house of madness.
It's funny. It kind of sounds like you're Richard Dawkins.
Well, that's British people.
I see.
There's only 3 or 4 British voices. I don't know if you recognize.
I never knew that. And I thought there were multiple British voices.
No. Hugh Grant sounds the exact same way.
I see.
You might not remember it correctly, but put me side by side on Notting Hill and it will sound the exact same.
Interesting.
So how do you know who Hugh Grant is?
Well, we get HBO in the heavens.
He has explained that before, to be fair. He has told us about the HBO access in the afterlife.
Yes, I'm quite thrilled with Silicon Valley and what the boys are getting through right now.
All right, so Mr. Hooke, why don't you explain to the audience who you are and what your accomplishments are as a scientist?
Yes, I noticed that there was not a lot of reverence when I said the name Robert Hooke.
I mean, you were famous, of course, for captaining a vessel, losing a hand, and then eventually trying to fight Peter Pan and the Lost Boys. Is that correct?
Yes. I was played by a pedophile in a story from an Englishman that's become quite popular. And I'm not a fan of that. I actually existed before that. Let me tell you a little bit about my accomplishments. I was the curator of experiments for the Royal Society. Now, to you Yanks, that may not sound like much, but that is a especially in the time that I existed, 1635. That is an incredible accomplishment. It meant I was only one of five educated men in all of the world at that time. I was a surveyor to the City of London after the Great Fire of London. In fact, I did over 50% of the surveying for the entire city. I was an important architect during my time. I was instrumental in devising a set of planning controls that London still uses today. Now, none of this sounds exciting, but what have you done with your life?
Plenty. A whole bunch.
Yes, I've listened to your last week's episode. You shot on another scientist's hard work for 20 minutes. That's your claim to fame, Mr. Timothy. You might appreciate this one. Because I was one of the first scientists to work with microscopes, I was a early proponent of biological evolution. Now, I know that just piggybacking on Darwin's hard work doesn't sound like much, but...
You would predate Darwin quite a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say...
By about 200 years. Darwin is closer to us now than he is to you.
Well, you see, I too was a bit of a medium, and I could see the future. I was a bit of a seer, a Nostradamus of my time. If I wasn't such an obscure scientist, you would know that the name Robert Hooke is synonymous with prophecy. I investigated the phenomenon of refraction and deduced wave theory of light. And I was the first to suggest that matter expands when heated and that air is made of small particles separated by relatively large distances. I came near the experimental proof that gravity follows the inverse square law. I was involved in the work that led to the first modern planned form map. Have none of you guys heard of Robert Hooke? None of you?
I mean, I'm aware of you, yes.
You're aware of me? Okay. Well, do you know why you've never heard of Robert Hooke?
I believe you had some beef. I believe the issue was that you had some drama, some 17th century science beef that went bad.
Correct, yes. You have to understand, near the end of my life, I became a very jealous and petty man. There's evidence of me stealing other people's scientific experiments. A lot of people became jealous of that. As a matter of fact, I tried to do the same in a dispute with Sir Isaac Newton, and I did not know that he would be the next curator of the Royal Society and would use his position to erase every trace of Robert Hooke. I only have one portrait made, and it hung in the Royal Society, and Sir Isaac Newton had it destroyed. So don't piss off Sir Isaac Newton, or nobody will know who you are. I'm actually his slave in the afterlife as a...
Wow, I didn't realize that's the way it works.
Yes, if you erase somebody from history, they become your slave in the afterlife.
Genghis Khan must have a fuckload of slaves in the afterlife.
Oh, yes, Genghis and his posse run deep.
So as a slave, you still get to watch HBO?
I'm going to be honest with you. Sir Isaac Newton is very autistic. It's hard to keep his attention towards anything but staring at the sun for hours on end.
Okay, so basically you were a very influential scientist. You did a lot of work, also apparently a surveyor and architect, did a whole bunch of that kind of modern Renaissance man type stuff, and then you apparently got your entire legacy erased because you pissed off the wrong person on your way up.
Correct. Well, at the end of my career, I'd accomplished several things, and I just decided to be petty at the end and really kind of screwed myself. But I have seen many young scientists. As a matter of fact, I watched you during your youth, Mr. Timothy.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes, I know that you were quite a prestigious youth in building things mechanical. I, too, had a mechanical inclination. For example, as a youth, I dismantled a brass clock and built a wooden replica that, by all accounts, worked well enough. I mean... It couldn't tell time. I would not set your clock by it by any means, but it certainly spun.
Wait, granted, that is impressive for a child and all, but essentially what you just did is what, like, China does with iPhones? You just took it apart and built a shittier version of it?
If an 8-year-old redesigns a clock, is that what a parent said? You would have been a terrible father. John Hooke, by the way, who was a priest for the Church of England. I would love to see if your child were to build an iPhone at the age of 8. Would you shit all over what he did?
I mean, no, but if he was still bragging about it when he was a ghost, I think I might hold his feet to the fire a little bit.
I used it to establish what a brilliant youth I was. And I used it to compliment you as well, you todger-faced tallywhacker. I was very much like you as well. I believed in traps. As a matter of fact, all of my work, I use ciphers. So it also, that was another barrier to people knowing about my work, because I use ciphers in all of my work.
Wait, you used the worst X-Men ever in all of your work?
Yes, and once he died on an X-Men field team, when Wolverine would have been a perfectly acceptable substitute on the field team. But I digress. Oh yes, HBO and Marvel Comics. Those are my two vices in the afterlife, Ian.
Okay, so are you done? Can we prove you wrong now?
I welcome the challenge.
Ian, do you have any questions you would like to ask?
So what exactly about elasticity was it that you discovered?
I'm glad you brought that up, Ian. I wanted to go into it a bit more, but for brevity's sake, I let it be. I discovered the law of elasticity, which describes the linear variation of tension with extension in an elastic string.
And what were the experiments set up like?
Well, you see, there were several women running around the site. They didn't have the right, so I would take their bra straps, and I would grab it and pull it back, and then let it go and snap them in the back. And I considered that quite the experiment. And it also was a wonderful way to get topless ladies into my lab.
I don't think that was it, but you know what? I'll build on Ian's disproving you. You also spoke about the inverse square law, which is a very important part of physics, especially when we talk about gravity. Why don't you explain to us what exactly that means?
What it means is that a square is looks the same no matter which way you turn it.
No, that is not what that
means. Unlike a rectangle or a rhombus, for example, a square could simply look like a diamond, perhaps.
No, that is not what it means. It refers to how gravity works on large-scale structures and the distance by which it works as you back away from gravity as opposed to losing gravity's force arithmetically. You actually lose it by the inverse square law, which means that gravity drops off drastically as you get further and further away from a particular object. Boom! Once again, good job, Ian. Together we teamed up to prove Damien is, of course, lying.
That is not at all what I discovered. No, I mean, maybe this is a good thing that I was left in obscurity, because I told you exactly what I discovered from the
inverse square law.
Oh,
that was your inverse square law.
Yeah, I think perhaps somebody, it sounds like somebody had a few addendums onto the idea.
I'm thinking Newton was right to bury you then. All right, get out of here. We don't need you anymore.
I'm off to go service my master. Coming, Mr. Newton. Goodbye. Who is it this time? And are you convinced?
Robert Hooke, and no.
Wait, the pedophile who wanted to kidnap Peter Pan?
Yeah, actually it was.
What did he do? Advances in pedophilic science?
crocodile dental research?
All right, well, I'll listen to the episode and get back to you. Thank you very much. This has been Damien Channels, a dead scientist.
And thank you, Ian, for coming out. Thank you, audience, for listening to Science Faction 173, where you learned about the Mesoproterozoic. How your grandmother smoking might cause your autism. How you might get your exercise just from a pill in the near future. Why Neanderthal skeletal injuries look like injuries from water tubing. How the Vancouver Police Department found a bird's nest made completely of opiate needles. How new researchers might have just found a new species of polar bear. And how swearing might increase your strength. Thank you so much for joining us. Come on back next week for Science Faction 174.
Here in Vancouver, we are cursed with the largest pigeon opioid epidemic in North America. And then again, we have the best pigeon jazz in North America, too.
You've been listening to Science Fiction. Wait, that's not right.